Okay, so good morning, everyone. So for those of you, it's, at this point I assume you know, my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Sgan Rosh Kol of the Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which is a long name. That's nothing we can do about it. As Rabbi Tertiner likes saying, our name is bigger than, you know, well, our organization. But, okay, so first of all, I know before the class, a lot of talk of politics. Let us hope that whatever you thought of the election, whoever you supported, there was a lot of acrimony in this, a lot of name calling, a lot of identity politics in both directions. And whoever you supported, we should pray that we move forward and that it is good. Whether you thought it was going to be good before or whether you have your doubts, I think we can all agree that we pray that it will turn out for the best. I was asked this morning, I was already scheduled at Or Chaim to speak after davening to the high school students, which meant I had to say something about the election. I tried to get the principal to do it in my place, and everyone refused. Maybe if we have time at the end, after we've explored Avram's personality, I will share my thoughts from Avram and the election. But we'll see if we get there. Okay. So the topic that I want to cover for the next 6 weeks is the question of arguing with God. Oh, I meant to bring in the book. There was a book written on this topic. I'm sure some of you have seen it by, I'm not even sure how to pronounce his name, Anson Leitner. He was a rabbi in Seattle, I think reform rabbi in Seattle, wrote it in the late 80s, I believe, called Arguing with God. And when you look through the Bible, or you look through the Midrashim, you will find that while, if you'd asked me in a vacuum, I'd never read the Bible, I was just, you know, someone who believed in God, but I never actually read the texts, and you asked me, can you argue with God, I would have said, no. Right? Why should you be able to argue with God? Right? God is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-moral, all-truth. So why should a human being be able to argue with God? And yet, we find time after time that people do argue with God in different ways for different reasons. As we'll see, sometimes people seem to challenge, as we'll see in the case of Avram, God's morality. And sometimes those same people who challenge God's morality, in other times, don't challenge God's morality, which begs the question, when can you challenge God's morality, when can you not? There are people who challenge God simply because they're in pain. And we'll explore in a few weeks the case of the blasphemer. The book on the topic is Job, which I chose to leave out of it for the simple reason that either you devote 6 weeks to it, to Job, or you devote no time to it. It is because the whole book is really building on that tradition. But that's the classic example of someone who's arguing from pain. There are people who argue with God, as we'll see in the case of Moses, to defend the Jewish people. They argue for our right to be humans and even make mistakes. And what I want to explore in the next few weeks is, why is it legitimate? When is it legitimate? What does it even mean to argue with God? And how can we as human beings, or why should we or can we, argue with God? And we're going to explore six instances, if we get to all of them, where people did do this, where they argued with God. And I want to try to understand the stories that we're reading, but also, and this is the goal of that book that was written, right, Arguing with God, to think about in what ways this can be part of our religious experience. Right? We tend to, most of our prayers are not arguing with God. We beg God, we admit that we're wrong, we admit we've made mistakes, we say, right, if we're like children, then have mercy on us. If we're like your servants, so then we're at your mercy and we have nothing to say, but please have mercy on us. We talk supplication. And when things are bothering us, we pray to God and we say, please help us. But we often don't challenge God and say, why are you doing this to me? Or we feel guilty when we do. And the question is, do we have to? Or do we have that right? Do we have the right to say to God, you shouldn't be doing this? Or maybe you have your reasons, but from my perspective, I don't understand it. So I need to be able to vent. I need to be able to have that relationship and argue. So those are the types of questions I want to keep in mind as we explore these stories. Okay, so with that in mind, the first character who will explore, who argued with God, was Abraham. And what I want to do is explore two stories. One, where Abraham argued with God. And after we've explained how and why Abraham argued with God, then what I want to do is figure out why. The first story where he argues with God, as we'll see, is the case of the destruction of Sodom of Amorah. I will use Amorah, right? The Gomorrah is because the ayin and the G are both gutturals, and then when it changed into English, it changed from the ayin to the G, right? Hence Aza and Gaza, right? Things like that. They actually come from the same part. We don't think about it that way because we tend to pronounce ayin from up here, not as a guttural, not an ayin, but anyways, an ayin sounds more like a G. But for me, it's easier to talk about it as Amorah. And once we see that Avram did argue with God, it becomes all the more striking that in perhaps the most famous moment of Abraham's life, the Akedah, the binding of his son, he does it without a word. So what I want to do is explore those two stories, right? One, the case when he does argue. Two, the case where he does not argue. And I want participation. I want, as we go along, I want you to tell me, right, why you think he's arguing, what it means, and why he can argue when he does, and why he doesn't argue when he doesn't. And at the end, if we have time, what that means to you. If we don't have time, then that will have to be the thing that we keep in mind and develop as the classes go on. Okay, so, story number one. Now, I've found this, as I've been preparing this series, I found this very helpful to me. Especially when it comes to these stories, which tend to be very evocative emotionally, there is a wealth of artistic material that you can find of biblical-themed paintings, famous paintings. The first one that I have here is not as famous as the second one, right? The one that I have here for Abraham arguing with God is actually from when Abraham sees Sodom in flames, but I think it captures the feeling that he has, which is from James Jacques Joseph Tissot, I think that's how you pronounce it. And then for the binding of Isaac, I have what I think is one of the most intense pictures, which is the Caravaggio on it, or Caravaggio, whatever, right? Where even just looking at the pictures, the contradiction to me is clear. Right here, you have Abraham looking in horror as the city is going to be destroyed and arguing with God. But if you look at the top of the second page, here's Abraham with a knife to his son's throat, right? Not arguing. And even if you, without knowing the stories, you look at the pictures, how can it be the same person who stands there, right, in this picture and says, God, how could you do this? And in the second picture, right, takes the knife himself and listens to what God says without any challenge. So you'll see that at least so far I've prepared my source sheets for the first three lessons. I have an image, at least one image from each of these scenarios from art, just so we can even just see how in the world of art these tensions have been captured. Because often we say that, right, a picture is worth 1,000 words. But it really is, right? You look at the two pictures, and the tension becomes even clearer than it does by reading the stories. But that brings us to the first story. So, God has just chosen Abraham, not that long ago. And he's told him, leave your land and go. Go to the land of Canaan, go to Israel. I'm going to make you a great nation. And he said, I task you with bringing my name to the world. And then he looks around. And God sees that within the land of Israel, there are five cities. Five corrupt cities. Morally, sexually, their ethics are, right, they're just overflowing with corruption. And he decides that he needs to destroy them. And then, in what is, it seems to be inexplicable, he decides that he can't. He can't just destroy them without turning to Abraham. Right? So he says, right, now we start. Oh, you know what? I'm just going to take this one. In my original, I didn't do this. What I did to make this easier is, you know, in Word, you can do, right, view page lines. So this way, feel free to jump in the middle with the page lines. This way, we can always come back to where we are. Okay, so now the Lord had said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham is to become a great and populous nation, and all the nations of the earth are to bless themselves by him. For I have singled him out that he may instruct his children and his posterity to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is just and right, in order that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised him." So God says, I must turn to Abraham. I must tell him what's going on. Why? Right? Why does God need to tell Abraham? Because if we want to see why Abraham argues, we need to figure out why God gave him the opportunity to argue. Why does he need to tell Abraham?
He tells you, he says, I have singled him out that he may instruct his children by doing what is just and right. So God is basically saying, what I'm doing is just and right, and Abraham has to understand that my next action is just and right, because I expect Abraham to continue to do what is just and right.
Exactly. I think that has to be at least part of the answer. Right? That he has chosen him to bring justice, right, morality to the world. And therefore, he needs him to understand that what he's about to do is morally correct. But there's multiple components, I think, to that. Because there's two things that are about to happen that require Abraham to see the morality in them. One is what God is about to do. But the other is... What? Well, that's part of it, right? Abraham's going to be involved in this process. But there's something subtle. Because in the end of the day, he's going to lose, right? God's going to destroy Sodom. He needs him to understand why what Sodom did deserves destruction. Meaning, the justice is God is just and Sodom is the antithesis. So he needs them both to understand what injustice looks like and what justice looks like. So he brings Abraham into the conversation. He needs to explain to him why Sodom deserves destruction. That has two prongs, right? It's why what they did was wrong and therefore what justice looks like.
Well, but in effect, then, it's a huge learning experience.
Exactly.
For Abraham, and so it's like what we would call a life-changing event.
Yes.
It's massive. It's
correct. And I think that's right. That it is, that he is inviting Abraham to argue to train Abraham. Right? There are some commentaries who deny this. Right? There are some commentaries who say that God is simply telling Abraham because, look, he's about to destroy five cities in Israel and he promised to give him Israel. So this, you know, he needs to tell Abraham because it's like, look, I understand I told you I'd give you the land, but there's extenuating circumstances and some of these cities just need to be destroyed. But the simple read of the story is he needs to teach Abraham what it means to be just. And he's going to do that through this experience. Yeah.
So up until now, men have acted like beasts without thinking through issues. This is now the first time where man is going to reason.
So, or at least, or it's an elevation of his reason. I don't know if they were total beasts, but yes, like Noah, he's told about it but says nothing. Right? This is the first time that someone has the audacity to take on God. Seemingly because God wanted him to take him on. Right?
I have a problem with all of this because we've just been doing in another study group the whole question of Noah and God erasing the people from the earth and giving us a second chance and also that discussion. But here too, God created man in his image, supposedly.
Could you speak a little louder?
God created man in the image of God, and that we would be, we were instructed, or we're instructed to be like, godly-like, and to act godly-like. Okay, we had the Garden of Eden, which changed a lot of that with free will. But if, how come so much of us is so bad? Because it goes from generation to generation to generation, and if God created us with this terrible, these streaks of terrible behavior, which we repeat and repeat and repeat, did he really do his job? And that troubles me in all of these stories, because...
Are you arguing with God?
I am arguing with God, especially today I'm arguing with God. And it's disability and the way we choose to behave our lives.
So it's interesting that, right, in the Noah story, God explicitly says, I will never destroy the world again because I know that you're flawed, and therefore I need to be more forgiving, right? And we'll see that in the Midrash, which I put here in number two, right, we'll see that Abraham's argument, now I'm gonna have restraint and I'm gonna hold off on it, right? We're going to see, right, the classically understood, Abraham is arguing with God morally. But in the Midrash, he's not. He's arguing with him based on the story of Noah, right? He's going to say to God, not you're being immoral, is you admitted that it's your fault, right? And that's his argument. So we're going to come back to it, but you're right. Meaning the Midrash picks up on that question and says that his argument wasn't what you're doing is wrong. It's your fault, and you already said it was your fault, so how are you doing what you're doing? But yes, you're right, that part of the problem is we have to understand, what is Abraham arguing, and is he saying God is wrong, or is he saying you're right, but it's your fault? Yeah.
I just wondered why God argued with Jonah to save the people of Nineveh. That was a whole... Why did he save those people, but not...
So let's hold that question, because I think that will be answered here, right? The question of when God says there's hope and when he doesn't, I think is part of Abraham's dialogue. Yeah?
But Adam argues with God too. The woman you gave me, it's her fault I ate.
Sort of, right? He that's well, the you're right, it's self-defense. It's, you know, why did you do it?
Wasn't my fault, and you gave me that woman.
Yeah, and you know, the Arachayim goes as far as to say what he was really saying was, if you actually follow the text carefully, Chava never told him that this was from the, right, the tree of good and evil. So he was actually literally saying, it's not my fault, I didn't know, right? She never told me, and you...
You're punishing me for something I knew nothing about.
You're right, so you do have that type of argument, right? Okay. So let's see what actually happens. So then the Lord said, the outrage of Sodom and Amorah is so great, their sins so grave, I will go down to see whether they have acted altogether according to the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will take note. Now, first thing, right, that's interesting here is that if our thesis is correct that God is trying to train him what justice looks like, first thing is... Yeah, check it out yourself, right? That justice requires, right, not jumping to conclusions. Even God, so to speak, doesn't judge, because he doesn't need to jump, right? God isn't jumping to conclusions, right? God doesn't need to go down and see what's going on. He knows what's going on. If he's telling Abraham he's going down to look, it must be he wants Abraham to understand the importance in justice of, right, ascertaining your facts. So then he says... The men went on from there to stone while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Right? So while this is happening, the angels start heading towards stone to actually destroy. So right, this is the bottom of the ninth. He's telling him, right? It's over, right? They're already going. Like, either you pull out a miracle or they're going to be destroyed, right? This is not an early stage in the process. Just understand that. So Abraham came forward and said, will you sweep away the innocent along with the guilty? What if there should be 50 innocent within the city? Will you then wipe out the place and not forgive it for the sake of the innocent 50 who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the innocent as well as the guilty, so that innocent and guilty fare alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? And now... There's a lot packed into that, but I want to read just two more sentences. And the Lord answered, if I find within the city of Sodom 50 innocent ones, I'll forgive the whole place for their sake. Abram spoke up, saying, here I venture to speak to my Lord. I who am but dust and ashes. But if the 50 innocent shall lack five, will you destroy the whole city for the want of five? And he answered, I will not destroy if I find 45 there. So here are the questions I want to answer. First, on what basis does Abraham argue with God? And what gives him the right to argue with God? And two, something I want to point out here. The first time he opens his conversation, you hear anger, indignance, audacity, right? Who are you, O judge of the world, to kill the innocent? And then his next line is, look, I'm sorry I'm bringing this up again, but look, 50 minus 5 you're going to destroy. Then I'm dust and ashes. Who am I to talk? What happens between line 1? Because he's still arguing with God in both cases. But in the first one, he turns to God and says, this is not just. What are you doing? How could you destroy them? And the next line, he's still arguing with God, but it's, I'm sorry, I'm talking, dust and ashes, right? Right? What happened between stage 1 and stage 2? And is there a different argument going on in the two levels? Okay, so what do we think in stage 1 is Abraham's argument, and what gives him the right to argue? I throw it to you.
The fact that God even told him gives him some right, because if God didn't want some action or some reaction from him, he wouldn't have told him. He would have just gone ahead and destroyed the cities.
Good. So on the very basic level, I think it's undeniable that what allows him to talk is that God told him, I'm about to destroy Sodom, which implies, right, it's when someone if someone can act unilaterally, and they bring in their subordinate to tell them what they're doing, it's because they want them to talk, right? They want advice, or they want them to say something. That, I think, is clear. To take that a little bit farther, I think it's not just that. It's the fact, why did God tell him in the first place, right? So what did he say? Because he made a commitment to him. Or in other words, he has a covenant with Abraham. The covenant is what made God feel that he needed to tell Abraham, and it was that covenant that triggered God telling him, that in turn triggered Abraham's right. Right? And right, so Reuel ben Nun argues that the fundamental key here is that word covenant. Right? Is, yes, God, what told Abraham that he was allowed to argue was that God told him. But the reason that God bothered telling him was because he had a covenant. And he uses this to explain what for him is the hardest part of the story, which is, and I'll take the question in just a second. These arguments sound very much like the arguments Job makes for himself. Right? I was innocent. And in fact, we know from the beginning of the story, he was innocent. Right? It's worse. Right? Here, Abraham is arguing to defend people who were not just. Job argues, and he in fact is just. But God himself tells you that at the beginning of the story. And yet, God gets angry at Job for challenging him. So Reuel ben Nun says the simplest reason that he's allowed to argue is because there's a covenant, and therefore God initiates conversation. Right? It's not even the inherent justice of the issue, it's whether God cared to ask you. Okay. Yeah, question then question. Yeah.
Before there was a covenant with Avraham and Hashem, there was Avram. And Avram initiated the idea of right and wrong by destroying the idols in his father's home. So he had a moral compass already within him.
So that's the interesting thing, is that the Midrashim play up the notion that, you know, he destroyed the idols and the things like that. But the interesting thing is in the Psukim, right, in the verses, they actually don't tell you what he did. Right? Right? The verses are particularly opaque as to why God chose him in the first place. Right? This is where we find out why he chose him. But this is the first time we hear it. Right? I mean, the Midrashim fill in the gaps. Right? What indicated to God that he was moral? But when the verses themselves don't tell you until this point that he has that moral compass, which is, right, interesting, right? It chooses to tell us this explicitly in this context. Yeah?
Is it possible that if God is testing Abraham to see how morally confident he really is because he's going to be the leader of a nation and he better, you know, have certain qualities?
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true. That is right. He's testing him to see whether he's going to live up to his responsibility. Now, here we're going to come back to the question of Jonah. Okay? And I think the key to your question about Jonah, remind me your name again.
Sheila.
The key to, I think, Sheila's question about Jonah is, right, we'll answer that question by re-asking the other question I asked. What happened between stage one and stage two? Well, you know what? Actually, no, I need to do one thing before that. Okay. On what basis, though, is he arguing? We now have said what right he has to argue, but what is his argument? Right? Right? Far be it from you, the judge of the whole world, to kill the innocent with the guilty. So, possibility one is that is an argument from, as many people take it, morality. Right? That this teaches you that man has the ability, the responsibility, and the right to call God out on morality. Right? Either, if you take in the extreme, which I don't think is plausible because you think morality exists beyond God, or more likely, simply, man has a responsibility to be moral with the belief that God is the one who created the world and its moral values, and therefore you're allowed to hold God accountable to his own moral values. That's possibility one. Possibility two, in the Midrash that we mentioned before, skip to two now, the Rav Acha said that Abraham argued, "You've sworn that you will not bring a flood to the world, so why are you being deceptive with your oath? A flood of water you shall not bring, but a fire you will bring? If so, you have not fulfilled your oath." Rabbi Levi said, "Shall the judge of all the earth not perform justice? If you desire the existence of the world, there cannot be judgment. But if you desire judgment, then there can be no world. How can you grasp the rope from both ends? You want both a world and a judgment? Pick one of them. But if you do not relent a little, the world cannot endure." Right? And this is your point, right? He's not just arguing from morality. He's arguing from human frailty. He's saying, you admitted that you created a frail, flawed creature called man. You can't have it both ways, God. It's either justice or it's mankind. Do you want us here or not? Right? So those, I think, are the two main ways he's arguing. But now coming back, okay. So whether he's turning to God and saying, "I'm judging you by your own moral standards," or he's saying, "I'm judging you by your own admission that mankind is flawed and that's your fault. So deal with the consequences because you can't complain that man is flawed because who made us that way?" Right? You did. So those are two great arguments. Then why does he back down as soon as he gets from 50 to 45? So here is where we come to the Jonah thing. If we think about the Jonah story, why did God tell Jonah, tell the people of Nineveh to repent? Because?
To give them another chance.
To give them another chance, and I think even more, he knew that there was a strong possibility they would actually take it. Or they would actually change, as they evidenced by the fact that they did. Right?
But he tells Moses to tell Pharaoh to repent, and he don't.
Correct. There's at least a chance, right? He's giving him a chance. And in the case of Nineveh, it actually works.
But he never gave these people a chance.
Ah, and that's the key. Did he give them the chance? And I think that's what's going on right here. Right? Abraham says to him, listen to the difference between argument 1 and 2. What if there should be 50 innocent within the city? Will you then wipe out the place and not forgive it for the sake of the innocent 50 who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the innocent as well as the guilty, the innocent and guilty fair alike. Right? Far be it from you, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly. Here he's telling it's not fair. If there are 50 innocent people, you're going to wipe out the whole city. But I think what he's really saying is, right? Because God, what could God have said? Right? Abraham's not being fair to God. Because God could say, no, I'm not going to do that. What am I going to do?
Wipe out only the guilty.
Yeah, he has an easy argument. Abraham is drawing a false distinction, right? Either you're going to destroy the innocent, or you're going to forgive everybody. God could have said, no, I'm not. Right? I never said that. Right? I said, I'm destroying the evil in stone. But the good people, you're right, I'll just take them out and I'll plop them on the side and all will be good. And then, would that silence Avraham? Now, right, Abraham would say, oh, well, in that case, that's all good. Right? I'm okay with this. It sounds like not. Right? Because God doesn't answer that, which means that Avraham wasn't giving him the option. But why? And I think the answer is because Avram was really saying, is it fair to not give people a chance if they might repent? He said, look, every society can be shaped if there are good people in it. But you're going to wipe them out before you give the good people a chance? How many does he assume they need? 50. Which the way the Midrash takes it is, why 50? Because there are 5 cities. 10 is the smallest number we consider a community in Eidah. So there's a community, a core community, each of the cities. You're going to destroy them before you give a chance to the people to change the community? Because a small nucleus of good people can change the community. Hence Nineveh. And then God said something that devastates Avram. Avram, there isn't 50. Right? There isn't 50. There isn't a community. There isn't a nucleus in each of the 5 cities. And now Avram's stuck. Because now if you want to argue from justice, and you want to save all the cities, not just the 45 innocent people, on the level of justice, if there isn't even a nucleus of a moral community that can change the ways, and you admit that Sodom is corrupt, then what's he going to say to God? He has no argument. So now Avram takes a second tact. He says, look, I get it. This is not going to be Nineveh. There is no nucleus to make them better. But I'm only dust and ashes. And from my perspective, look, if you're willing to save them for 50, for 45, you're not going to have a little mercy, right? But now you realize he's not arguing justice anymore. Right? The first one, he has temerity, he has gall. He says, that's not fair. So he yells at God. He challenges God. He accuses God. Yeah, because if there's a nucleus of 50 people, they could change. And it's not fair, either because it's not moral or because you know we're flawed. How can you not give us a chance? But if there isn't even a nucleus and the chance of anybody changing is near impossible, now you're at God's mercy. Right? Now you're not appealing to justice. You're not even appealing to God's covenant, right? Oath. You're appealing straight to mercy. And that takes a lot of guts. So now Avram says, look, I tried the first time. By right, God, you can destroy them and save the 45 people. Fine. But don't you have some mercy? Don't I have the right to go beyond justice and ask you for mercy? And God tells him, you do have that right. I'll let you. And then Avram continues. Now, if you go back to the story, right, line 22. But he spoke to him again. He said, oh, what about 40? Right, if 40 are there. So God said, I won't do it for 40. And then he does it 30 and does it 20. And then finally, in line 26, he said, let my Lord not be angry if I speak, but this last time. I know. I get it. I really get it. There aren't even 20 people in the city. They're not going to change. But don't you have mercy? Maybe they'll change somebody. They won't change the whole city. But mercy. Can't you have mercy? I'm going to try one time. 10 people. Are there 10? And God says, look, my mercy will go that far. If there's even 10 people, right? There's a community scattered through the 5 cities. It may not even influence them, but maybe it will. I'm willing to listen. And God devastates Avram, and he says, I will not destroy for the sake of the 10. But there aren't 10. And then, at that point, line 30, when the Lord finished speaking to Abraham, he departed, and Avram returned to his place. Avram has to give up. Because he's used morality, he's used the covenant, he has talked about human frailty, he said, isn't there hope, isn't there somebody who can change their ways, anybody? And God says, no, there isn't. I really do need to destroy them.
So why does he save
Lot? Ah, and this comes back to why doesn't he save Lot?
Why does he?
And this is the question that we came to before, right? Avram set up a false dichotomy. He said, God, are you going to destroy the innocent with the guilty? Or are you going to let everybody live? But he left out the middle option, which is you're going to save the good people. I would suggest that that was always part of the plan. Right? That God never was going to kill the innocent. And that's why he takes out Lot, who at least relatively is innocent. Meaning he never planned to destroy the innocent. Abraham didn't give God that choice because God was never going to destroy the innocent. He used it as a false argument to challenge God's morality, to emphasize that it's not fair to society to say, okay, I'll leave the bad and I'll take away the good, right, without giving the good a chance to change the bad. But if in the end of the day they're so corrupt, there's not anybody who can change them, then yes, they deserve destruction. But Lot, who's relatively innocent, still gets a right to be saved.
And
because God never...
It's this immoral behavior.
Correct. But it's an ambiguous immoral behavior, right? They do it because they think the world has been destroyed, and they do it to preserve humanity. So, it's maybe not great, right? But there's redeemable mistakes in the daughters of Lot.
They're so bad that God tells us later never to marry them. Never to marry their offspring.
Correct. Right, at least the males, correct.
I took you and out, you made a mistake, and you fornicated with your father, you made a nation,
right.
Which was a bad thing to do.
But on the flip side, God tells the Jewish people, don't try to attack the lands of Lot, ki levnei Lot nasati Yerusha. Nisati Yerusha, I've given this as their inheritance. On the one hand, yes, the Jews can't marry them. On the other hand, God gives them ancestral lands on the borders of Israel. Right? Lot is... And his daughters are an ambiguous figure, right? And in the end of the day, what that tells you is that God saves even people who have questionable morality, who are somewhat redeemable, right? God, Abraham goes through the process. Will you save people because there's a chance for repentance? And God says, yes, by right I will do that. But that doesn't work. So Abraham says, okay, forget rights. Forget the covenant. Forget human frailty. Mercy. Do you have mercy? And God says, yes, I have mercy. But mercy has its limits. And this is the educational experience that Abraham gets. Because on the one hand, he learns to fight for morality, to fight for the covenant, to fight for recognition of human frailty. But in the end of the day, the lesson God teaches him when the argument fails, right? He learns that through arguing, but through the rejection of his arguments, he learns another lesson, which is, there are limits. That kindness also has limits. Because justice requires sometimes we make hard decisions. And now if we come back to the opening, God says to Abraham, I need you to go through this experience because you need to build a nation. You need to have empathy. You need to fight for morality. You need to fight. You need to recognize human frailty and have mercy on it. But you can't let your mercy and your desire to judge the sinners favorably lead you to the point when there's actual evil staring you in the face that you don't do anything. There must be a limit. And you need to learn how to balance that just like he does in this argument. Right? And that is the formative experience that Avram goes through. Right? He learns how to fight for morality, to fight for empathy, to fight for justice, and also learns that with all that, there's a limitation, which is that you need to have mercy on the people who are suffering when there isn't justice. Right? Mercy goes both ways. And if there's irredeemable evil, then you need to speak to it. You need to respond. Yeah?
In the Nineveh, the animals are included. Here, there's no mention of animals.
Correct. I don't know what to make of that. But yes, the animals are brought into the repentance structure in Nineveh.
Or into the repentance.
Or maybe into the sin, but...
Yeah, yeah.
So in Saul commanded to kill...
Correct, and Amalek, you kill the animals as well, correct.
Maybe God realized he should have killed the animals in Storm, and maybe now he should. Next time he's not going to make that mistake.
Maybe. Okay. So now,
this Moses, this Abraham that argued with God, and we're going to argue with the other half, why doesn't he speak up when he's sacrificing?
Let's move to that, right? So now that we've set out what God, when Abraham argues and what lessons he learned and when he doesn't argue, so then the question just stares you in the face, right? If you, I guess this printing did come out, okay? You can see it, if you haven't seen it, you can look at it online and see the color of the Caravaggio, and in the colorful you'll see. How did that same person who argues for morality and justice and then mercy, right? Think about it. He goes through several stages of saying they're irredeemable, but redeem them anyways, right? And then here's Abraham when God tells him, right, the story. Sometime afterward, God put Abraham to the test. He said to him, Abraham, and he answered, here I am, right? This story is famous. And he said to him, take your son, your favorite son, Isaac, whom you love. Go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the heights that I will point to you. And now you expect him to turn to God and say, okay, I get it. Sodom, they weren't innocent. It was irredeemable. My son is righteous. He's perfect. You promise him to me. This goes against morality. It goes against justice. It goes against the covenant. It goes against you. It goes against all those same things, right? Whether it was morality, where's the morality? Whether it was the covenant, I have a covenant. You promised me a child to build a nation. And what does he do? So early the next morning, Abraham saddled his ass, took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. He split the wood for the burnt offering. He set out for the place God had told him. No challenge. He gets up early the next morning. He does it. He's fine. On the third day, Abraham looked up and he saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his servants, you stay here with the ass. The boy and I will go up there. We'll worship. We'll return to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering. He put it on his son Isaac. He took the fire stone and the knife, and the two walked up together. It's just like, oh, that sounds fine. We're going to do this. I'm going to go. It's all okay, right? He doesn't challenge, doesn't do anything. And how long did he have? 3 days. He's walking in a desert for 3 days contemplating this, and it never crosses his mind to challenge God, right? It's not like, right, he doesn't challenge him in the beginning. Okay, maybe he's shocked. But the Torah goes out of its way to tell you, he has 3 days, right, to travel. Nothing, never crosses his mind. More than that, then he takes his servants and says, you stay here, I'm going to go with the lad by himself. Then Isaac said to his father, Abraham, father, and he answered, yes, my son. And he said, here are the fires from the wood, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will see to the sheep for his burnt offering, my son. And the two of them walked on together. Then he's walking with his son alone. Nobody's there. He's left, and Isaac has sharpened the question for him, right? Isaac is starting to suspect what's about to happen. Right? And Abraham answers with this ambiguous, painful answer. God will show the lamb, meaning you. Right? And stage by stage, the Torah tells you, he didn't challenge him when he first heard. He had 3 days of traveling, nothing. He separates and it's only Isaac, and Isaac brings up the question to Abraham? Nothing. Right? Silence. Acceptance.
And Isaac doesn't argue.
And they say nothing. And then they continue.
He's the next leader and he hasn't figured out.
Correct. And he hasn't, or he has realized what's about to happen. He doesn't argue. Right? And then they arrived at the place of which God had told them. Abram built an altar there. He laid out the wood. He bound his son Isaac. He laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abram picked up the knife to slay his son. And here's the picture. Right? He gets to this point. The knife is at his son's neck. Right? You see the, right? He's holding his neck with a knife. Right? Nothing. Silence. Right? And then an angel of the Lord called him from heaven, Abram, Abram, and he answered, here I am. And he said, do not raise your hand against the boy or do anything for him. Now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your favored one, from me. And then Abram finds the ram, and he brings it, and then just the last paragraph, so let's just read the finish of the story. And the angel of the Lord, skip this next paragraph, but the final one, the angel of the Lord called to Abram a second time from heaven and said, by myself I swear, the Lord declares, because you have done this and not withheld your son, your favorite one, and I bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands of the seashore, and your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your descendants because you have obeyed my command. Not only does Abraham never say anything, but God, who was so ready to have Abraham argue for the sake of morality for stone, takes this as the epitome of Abraham's commitment. So it's not just, the question isn't just on Abraham, why don't you say anything? It's, God, why didn't you want him to say anything? Right? Didn't you want him to say anything? And the answer in the story seems to be no. Right? So why? What's the difference? Yeah.
Why he didn't say anything, the logic is that in the Torah, not everything is mentioned. That's a fact. Because Avram and Isaac were testing God. And that is what's not mentioned here.
Oh, so
the
I was
test wasn't God testing Avram, it was Avram testing God.
Okay, so...
Maybe Avram knew that God already taught him the lesson the last time. He knew that God would show mercy and justice, and he knew that it wasn't going to happen because that was what.
Okay. What else?
I think that's.
I'm going to get some answers here. First of all, the easiest answer is right. Let's say we weren't bound to the text. There's two extreme answers that could emerge. Right. One is he did argue. And the text didn't tell us that. Right? That's a theoretical possibility, which is in fact the position of the Midrash. Right? The Midrash, and like I said, I prepared a follow-up reading thing. So anything we discuss here, I'm going to send out later all these possibilities. I have another sheet, which you don't have yet, but I will send out after the class, with quotes of all of these. So one possibility is the Midrash, in fact, thinks he did. I'll read a line from it, right? He placed him upon the altar, Abram's eyes gazing to Yitzchak's eyes, and Yitzchak's eyes gazing towards heaven, and tears fell from Abram's eyes until he was swimming in tears, and he said to him, "My son, since you have already expressed your readiness to relinquish your blood, your Creator will find a different sacrifice in their place." At that moment, his mouth opened with a great weeping, and he sighed a great sigh, and his eyes wandered, and he looked at the Shekhinah, and he looked at God, he lifted his voice and said, right, Esai Nael Harim, May Ayin Yavo Ezri, I lift my eyes up to the hills, from when shall my aid come? My aid is from God, maker of the heavens and earth. The Midrash says, the answer is, he did. Right, maybe not the beginning, but before he did it, he turned to God and said, really? Right, there must be something else going on here. So, answer number one is, maybe he did. Right, the sages of the Midrash were so bothered by this question that they said it can't be, he didn't argue, it must be, he did. Possibility two, which is not going to work in the text, but is a theoretical possibility, and it's, you know, if I wanted to put a name on it, I would give it to Immanuel Kant, that's the quote I put here, is that he was wrong. You're right, the two stories don't work together because he should have argued and he didn't. Now, the text clearly doesn't view it that way, but Kant, in a passage that became famous among theologians because of the challenge it posed to religion, right, said, yeah, the answer to this question is there is no answer. He was just wrong. Right? Now, the Torah clearly doesn't believe that, right? God is totally okay with what he did. But, right, Kant was so bothered by this story that this was his proof that religion was incorrect. Right? This is Kant in The Conflict of the Faculties. Right? I didn't give it to you. I'm going to send it out. Right? But he says, but in some cases, man can be sure that the voice he hears is not God's. Right? Then he continues, and his last line is, Abraham should have replied to this supposedly divine voice. That I ought not to kill my good son is quite certain. But that you, this apparition, are God, of that I am not certain and never can be. Not even if this voice rings down to me from visible heaven. Right? So possibility two from Kant is, no, that's the point. It's wrong. The lesson of this story is it's wrong. I can't, right? There is no reconciling it. But the Torah clearly thinks that Avram is right. That Abram is right. And that the simple read of the text is not like the Midrash that he argued. It says he never argued. Right? So that brings it back to the question, okay, why didn't he argue? So, one possibility was, let me just say it again.
That he learned the lesson from the other side.
Right, so one could be, right, that he, which lesson?
That God was just and merciful,
and therefore
he wasn't going to make him actually.
Right. So some commentaries say, you know why he didn't argue? Because he learned from the first story that God would never do it. Because God is just. He didn't understand it, but he knew that this wasn't going to end. right? He was willing to go to that last moment, right? But he just wasn't going to do it. Now, that I'll just read you one line. Rav Elimelech Weitzman of Lezhensk, right? The Noam Elimelech says this. In truth, Abraham and Isaac knew that it was not God's intention to slaughter him. Abraham was driven by his faith that the two of them would return. Right? The answer is, yeah. Because he didn't need to argue anymore. He knew that it couldn't be. And this is at least part of what Kierkegaard argues. Right? If you ever read Fear and Trembling, it's worth the read by Søren Kierkegaard. He says that Abraham was the knight of faith because he was willing to do what God said and somehow believed the impossible would be true, that he would sacrifice his son and his son wouldn't die. Right? How that was going to happen, he had no idea, but he had faith that God would do it. Right? That's what he called. Abraham was the knight of faith. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just going to say, how many years was it between Sodom and this Akedah?
Sometime, but not... Right, many years. Correct.
So Abraham is already older. He's over 100-something.
Correct.
And he has this faith in Emunah. Sort of like Moshe at his... dying, he wants to argue, could I still go in there, but he can I still see the land of Israel? It's he's too old already to argue.
Interesting. Yeah. I would think that for his son, if ever he was going to pull out those energies, he'd find it in himself. Right? Meaning, the fact that maybe he's developed to a certain point, I think might be true, but the question is, what is that point? Right? What has he learned that makes him not argue? So, okay, yeah.
Okay, but if God's job, he says in the first part when he talks about Abraham, and he says, I singled him out that he may instruct his children and his posterity to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is just and right. So if God's objective was to teach Abraham how to do the right thing, that he should then teach his children. And then here he takes his child, Isaac, and he shoves him on the altar, and he says, okay, kill him. What does Isaac learn from this? Isaac didn't learn to argue back because, boy, my father didn't argue. He missed that whole love story because he wasn't there then.
Interesting. I mean, well, maybe that's part of what the Midrash is saying, is that, no, they both argue, right?
But that's only in a Midrash. The text doesn't say that.
Correct, correct.
And that's an interesting point. It's only in a Midrash. And so many of the Midrashim make excuses for God. And they allow, or they try to explain God's behavior because we would reject that behavior.
Correct.
And I question, I mean, why did we need all these explanations? That shouldn't the text on its own stand for the text that's from God?
Good. And we'll see that the Midrashim do go both ways. The Midrashim sometimes defend God and sometimes provide arguments against God that the text doesn't have, right? It cuts both ways.
Right.
Okay. A few other possibilities. One possibility, which I don't expect anyone to raise, but classical commentaries actually did. Rabbi Elazar Ashkenazi, Ben Natan HaBavli, he writes a commentary, not so well known. He writes a commentary on the Guide to the Perplexed. He is so bothered by this question, he has a simple answer. He says... never happened. It was a vision. It was a vision.
The
Akedah was a vision. And he's... Now, there were several commentaries on Maimonides who thought that Maimonides believed this. But the only one I know of who says that the reason he's convinced it never happened was because he didn't argue is this position. I've sent out the quote, my translation of the quote anyways, right? But he argues that it can't be. This whole thing had to be a vision because it just... God would never have asked. And how do I know? Because Abraham didn't argue. And he obviously would have if it was real. In a dream, there's no questions on dreams. Right? That's how bothered he was by this. Right? Because for him, the answer is yes. You're supposed to argue. If you don't argue, you must be sleeping. Right? That's essentially what he's saying. Or, as we saw, some people thought he didn't think it would happen. Or, according to Kant, he's wrong. Now, obviously, the Torah rejects that. But you see how bothered people were by this. Now, but is there a defense? Now, one possibility, and this is Kierkegaard in the end, what he says, and several Jewish thinkers have taken this as well, but Kierkegaard has written the treatise on it, was to argue that, look, we learn from story one that there is morality. We learn from story two that there are things more important than morality. And Kierkegaard comes up with this notion called the teleological suspension of the ethical, which means, right, that's very fancy language for all human beings are bound, don't worry, I'll send this out, that there are two, all human beings are bound to two levels of obligation, morality and divine command. 99% of the time, they overlap. But if they contradict each other, then you're bound to divine command. And the lesson, and this is coming to your point before, what?
Over morality.
This is Kierkegaard's theory. What Abraham was learning at this moment, and the reason he didn't argue, is because he was learning the potential of divine command to override morality. Now, the lesson from the fact that God didn't go through with it is that God doesn't usually make those contradict. But the theory, right, that the in principle statement that you're bound to more than just morality, and sometimes there are things which are beyond morality, either because there are things more important than morality, or because we recognize that as much as we think we understand about morality, God knows better. So if it ever came to that point where God would tell you what you understand to be morality is not right, what Abraham was learning is then you're bound to God. Right? And that's Kierkegaard's claim. Is that, yeah, the reason he doesn't argue is because he's learning something new. He's learning that there's something that sometimes, there's more to life than even morality, right? And I have here just a line from a recent article by Moish Navon, where he wrote, "I propose that the absurd notion that Abraham entertained was that the command itself would not contradict natural morality. And whereas Kierkegaard explained that Abraham made the leap of faith by the suspension of the ethical, I propose that Abraham made the leap of faith by suspension of judgment." Right? He says, I'm not willing to go as far as Kierkegaard because that bothers me. Right, to say that there's something more important than morality. But I'm willing to say that what he was supposed to learn was maybe you don't always understand everything. Right? Was that Abram was being asked to suspend judgment. He was learning that he doesn't know everything that's moral. Now, in the end of the day, he finds out that his intuition was correct. But he had to go through the process of realizing that as much as we have a responsibility for morality, we have to recognize that God knows better. Yeah, or something like that. The last explanation that I would suggest, right? So far we've seen either it bothered people so much, either they say he did argue, because how could he not, or it never happened, or it was wrong, right? Or in the middle, you say what he was learning is there's more to life than just morality. Either sometimes divine will overrides morality, or simply that sometimes you don't understand morality, and if God tells you what to do, then you gotta listen. But that leads me to the last explanation. There was an article in Judaism, 47, in volume 47, number 3, by John Levinson, professor of Bible at Harvard, where he, I won't read the whole quote, but I think he captured what many people say. Fundamentally, there's a difference between the two stories. Story one is not about Avram. So why did Avram bother telling him? Because he wanted a response. Story two is about Avraham. It is about Abraham. God doesn't want a response. Right? And as he says it, what he fails to see, he's talking about another commentary, not Abraham, right? Is that in the biblical text, sacrifice is not deemed unethical or irrational. And it requires no more of an act of faith to adhere to sacrificial demands than to require to adhere to ethical demands. And then I skip down. For the difference is one of context. The context of Sodom and Amorah is forensic. Meaning investigative. He's asking him to look at this and give him advice. Whereas that of the Akedah is sacrificial. In a forensic context, the death of an innocent person is an outrage. In a sacrificial context, since the offering is expected to be blemishless, the innocence of the human victims is no grounds for protest. Right? Now that's a striking claim, but it's, I think, worth thinking about that maybe the reason that he didn't argue is because it was framed as a command. Right? He wasn't being asked his opinion. Right? He was being asked to do something. Right? When God told him, I want your opinion, so he gave his opinion. But if God was asking to suspend judgment, the Bible, in addition to morality, believes in the value of sacrifice, even difficult sacrifice. And that's why Avram didn't think he could respond. Now remember, what he doesn't then conclude, it doesn't mention, is that in the end, God tells him no. Right? Meaning, what Avram at least thought correctly was that sacrifice is the highest value. What God taught him in the process is sacrifice won't come at the expense of morality. But that was something that Avram couldn't know if God didn't tell him. And that might be the lesson of the Akedah. But the reason he couldn't argue was because God hadn't told him that yet. So we take it together. What we see is, on the one hand, that man has the, at least under certain circumstances, the ability and maybe even the responsibility to argue with God on behalf of morality, on behalf of mercy, on behalf of justice. He has to recognize there are limitations to that, both because in order to be just, sometimes there are consequences, and you can't always have mercy, which is what he learns in Sodom. And then, when put it in context of the Akedah, some people look at it and say, no, the only lessons I care about are the ones in Genesis 18, is Sodom, and therefore the Akedah is either wrong, or it never happened, or he did argue. Or, the lesson of the Akedah is that even when you argue with God, and you are a defender of morality, there might be more to life than morality, or even if there isn't, there might be more to life than human understanding of morality, right? And you might, or as Levinson points out, you might at least have to learn the lesson, right? That sacrifice might come, right? Even against morality. In the end of the day, the answer is it doesn't. But the lesson of it, right? The reason he didn't argue was because he recognized the value of sacrifice, and that you can't argue against sacrifice. The lesson was that those two, morality and sacrifice, might usually won't, or maybe will never actually contradict, but he at least had to learn the power of sacrifice from this incident. So we see, on the one hand, the case in which you can argue, the limitations of argument, right? And, right, we should keep these in mind as we go to the next story. I'll take one question, then we're going to be over time. I'll stay around afterwards, but, you know, since we're at the hour mark, I want to let people go.
It's not a question, and it's not time for this, but it leads into the whole question of the Holocaust. I'm sitting here listening to the sacrifice of 6 million Jews, and God is all-knowing, and it happened. So I don't want to have this discussion now, but it will lead to...
Right, so I think we should keep in mind that the Holocaust, that's in fact where the book goes. The book is trying to provide a language for people to talk about the Holocaust, right? But I think that's something we can keep in mind as we develop the ability and limitations of arguing with God. Okay, again, anyone who hasn't signed up and wants to get the emails, just sign up. And if you haven't paid, you want to pay now or pay online, just let me know afterwards.